The British journalist William Dalrymple has spent decades reporting from India, and he never seems to run out of stories to tell.
People in America think of India as a country. In reality, it's much more a continent. It contains, like America does, every kind of climate from the high Himalayas through the deserts of Rajasthan down to the tropical south. And within that geographical area, you have this incredible spread of different religious systems, many of which go back to the beginning of man's thought about God.
Those religious systems are the focus of William Dalrymple's latest book. It's called Nine Lives. The nine lives in question are deeply religious people in South Asia. They are Hindus, Buddhists, Sufi Muslims, and more. They include monks and dancers and a man described as a feeder of skulls. Even in the context of India, they take their devotion to the limit. And the incredible variety of belief is what drew Dalrymple to talk with them.
People again talk of Hinduism as if it's a single faith. Hinduism is a vast network of different religious systems and different religious practices.
Now, in one of the early profiles, you meet a woman who is a Jain nun. Who are the Jains?
The Jains are, in a sense, the sister religion of Buddhism. A little bit older. This is the very sophisticated urban world of about 500 BC in the Ganges Basin, at the point when India was way ahead of most parts of the world, except a few cities around the Mediterranean. And this was one of the first great urban cultures of the world. The Jains, while having the same ideas as the Buddhists about wanting to keep away from the pleasures of the flesh and withdraw from the world and find yourself within, had a far more severe route to that. To give just two examples, Buddhist monks shave their heads. The Jains pluck out their hairs one by one in a ceremony that's deliberately painful. Likewise, Buddhist monks can beg, but Jain monks have to just signal hunger by arching their right hand over their shoulder. Beyond that, they're not allowed to ask for food, and they're never allowed to touch money of any sort.
But you meet a Jain nun who's clad in white, and there is a quote that strikes me, because this woman recounts to you that she's supposed to renounce all worldly pleasures, all attachments to anything, but she went and, well, she had a friend. She had a companion.
This was the one attachment that she had, and this was, you know, completely according to the Jain faith. Nuns are not, for obvious reasons of personal danger, not meant to wander around alone. But what my nun, Prasannamata Mataji, had found was that while she'd given up all her worldly wealth, while she'd given up her family, that was wandering the earth, treading as lightly as possible on the earth. They sweep the ground in front of them to make sure they don't step on ants, and they won't step on puddles in case there's some life form that they will hurt inside the puddles. Despite all those efforts that she was making, she did have this one attachment, which was her close friend, the nun who she walked with for 20 years. And when that nun got ill and found that she was dying slowly, she undertook what is for Jains the final stage of Jain asceticism, which, having given up all your goods and everything, you then start to give up food. And it's a process which they do over 2 to 3 years in a very set way that they've been doing for centuries. And, of course, they die. And this is, for them, they say this is not suicide. This is merely giving up one set of clothes to go on into the next life. Because, like the Buddhists, they believe in reincarnation.
There are so many things that are striking about that life and that way of life, point of view that you describe, and yet I'm leading up to something that struck me even more. You speak to this woman who became attached to her companion on the roads, and of course was deeply saddened when her companion, 20 years, and not only was she sad, she was disappointed in herself to be sad. She shouldn't have ever been that close to anybody at all.
Well, in both Buddhism and in Jainism, a lack of attachment also means a detachment. And to be truly detached, you can't love. You can't form close friendships with people. And she realized that she had not followed, in her view, the dictates of her faith because she loved her companion.
And she says, I was punished for that. I formed not just an attachment, but a strong attachment, and that left an opening for suffering. And that's the quote that struck me, because we have gone as far, I think, as you could imagine from the character in the American movie or the American country song who is encouraged to open themselves up and take a chance and take a risk on embracing the world. And this is someone going for the exact opposite
ideal.
This was
really the point of doing this book, because today we live with this illusion that we know the world. The reality, of course, is, and this became very clear after 9/11, that there's huge parts of the world which we know absolutely nothing about, particularly in areas of religion and philosophy. And the veneer of globalization is such a deceptive thing. And the idea that really inspired me with this book was to... India is, you know, these days is a very fast-developing place. You go to India, the economy is going to be overtaking the US by 2050. There are, outside my where I live in Delhi, there are now, you know, the headquarters of Google Asia, mm-hmm. back-office processing units. It's developing incredibly fast. There are, you know, coffee places like Starbucks. All over the world, you have this veneer of globalization, and yet you've only got to rub away that surface veneer. And you find huge, vast differences still in the world. And that, to me, is the job of the travel writer today.
I realize that you went looking among these different religions for professional reasons. You wanted to explain a subcontinent in a different way. But because you were spending time with so many people who were having such deeply intense personal experiences, I wonder if you were seeking anything yourself.
First of all, to make it clear, this was emphatically not a book about my religious search. I've tried as objectively as possible really to tell the stories of nine people and keep myself out of it. But there's no question that over the 25 years I've been there, India and the religions of India have completely altered the way I look at the world. And it's something you don't notice as it happens because it's a slow drip process. But I went to India I have an almost fundamentalist Catholic background. And I went to a monastic school, was brought up by Benedictine monks, had a wonderful education at a school called Ampleforth. But India changes everything. And I think the great lesson of India is pluralism, that it makes it very difficult to believe in only your own faith, that the faith you happen to have been born into is the only possible way of reaching God. The Indian idea that there are many ways up the mountain, I think, is a very powerful one.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
William Dalrymple, author of Nine Lives in Search of the Sacred in Modern India. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. And a lot more goods are rolling along the nation's highways these days. That's good news for the economy and also for truckers. Frank Morris of member station KCUR in Kansas City hit the road to see how the rebound in freight traffic is helping truckers.
Highway 71 going toward Kansas City. I'm trying to get over a lane, but I got this big truck blocking my way. There's a truck ahead of me and there's a truck behind me. There we go. Seems like there are more trucks on the road these days. Turns out there are.
Well, what we're seeing is a definite pickup in overall freight activity.
Tavio Headley, an economist with the American Trucking Association, says freight traffic has risen pretty steadily since late last year. This April was almost 10% better than the one before. The broad gauge ATA uses to monitor the trucking industry has climbed back to where it was just before the recession.
So that's very positive news.
Cause for celebration, even. The Truckers Jubilee, held at a truck stop in Oak Grove, Missouri, is part barn dance, part job fair. And at this one, job seekers have the upper hand. Sunday Muse Morton is here with O&S Trucking. She's got a roulette wheel, doling out trucker swag to entice would-be employees.
Because we're having to turn down freight because we don't have enough drivers. I mean, for all the freight shortage last year, it's coming back now stronger than ever, and we literally can't keep up.
Ronnie, what's the last name?
Over on the other side of the tent, Mark Welch is working for Landstar, a company that employs drivers who have their own trucks, so-called owner-operators.
Capacity right now is tight, to say the least, and we're anticipating it getting worse because a lot of owner-operators just left the industry in the last couple of years.
Some 1,700 small trucking companies folded just last year, yet even as the freight market improves, trucking businesses continue to go under. Semi-trucks lost a lot of value in the downturn. There was a glut. Now that freight is moving briskly again, the trucks are in demand. Since they're worth more, banks are more inclined to repossess them. 730 companies went under just in the first few months of this year. It could easily have been 731.
January, I thought I was going to have to quit. I was going to go ahead and file bankruptcy and be done with it.
Robert Manley got his banker in Marshall, Missouri, to give him a break, even though he'd fallen behind on the payments on his old truck.
Well, since the new motor I put in it, it's got 400,000 miles on it, on the motor, but the whole truck itself's got over 1,250,000.
With a strong increase in freight traffic early this spring, Manley was able to march back into his bank to settle up.
No, I went in person and got him the money. Signed the title over to me, took the title, went into the bank vault and put it right there.
You don't get rich driving a truck. Many drivers make less than $40,000 a year, some less than $30,000 for their long hours and weeks away from home. And as truckers say, if the wheels don't roll, they don't get paid. For now, Robert Manley and others like him are grateful they're rolling often enough and long enough to cover the bills. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Just before he was elected president, Senator Obama made a speech in which he laid out how he would revive the fight against poverty. If elected, he said he would focus on programs like the renowned Harlem Children's Zone.
An all-encompassing, all-hands-on-deck anti-poverty effort that is literally saving a generation of children in a neighborhood where they were never supposed to have a chance.
Now, President Obama wants to replicate the Harlem Children's Zone, and he's offering millions of dollars to communities ready to join him. The response has been tremendous. Nearly 1,000 organizations say they will apply for that money. The deadline is Monday. NPR's Larry Abramson has the first of two reports on the Promise Neighborhoods Initiative.
The Harlem Children's Zone is a place. It covers 97 square blocks of Harlem, a neighborhood legendary for great black culture and deep poverty. But it's also a program that wraps kids in a bundle of services to soften the daily blows of this harsh environment.
Okay, guys.
The Harlem Gems Head Start Center on 117th Street looks like many daycare centers. Okay. 3- and 4-year-olds play in a brightly colored glassed-in room and work on their ABCs with a New York accent. Like Head Start centers around the country, this school is open to all low-income families. But Director Deborah Carroll says the resources available here are not typical.
A typical Head Start would not have 5 teachers in the classroom. A typical Head Start might have 2. I say more than half of the funding comes from Harlem Children's Zone.
Deborah Carroll uses those extra resources to get kids ready for kindergarten, to overcome the gap that puts poor kids behind the eight ball. Visitors who doubt this is working are quickly corrected.
So you're trying to erase the achievement gap and get them where other kids would be.
We are doing that.
Yeah, you are doing it.
Yeah.
That rock-solid confidence is part of the air these kids breathe from the day they enter the zone to the day they leave. That same spirit continues at Promise Academy 2, a charter school that will be the next step for many of these preschoolers. Principal Kathleen Fernald has been teaching for nearly 40 years all over the country. She says she's never had access to such an array of services.
For instance, if a child misses a lot of school and has an attendance issue due to asthma, we connect the family to the Harlem Children's Zone Asthma Initiative. They then get a case manager at the Asthma Initiative who goes to the families. They bring a HEPA vacuum cleaner. They help educate the families on keeping a dust-free home.
These efforts have achieved some impressive results. Higher test scores, more kids getting into college. That's why the Obama administration wants to sow these seeds across the country with the Promise Neighborhoods Initiative. Jim Shelton of the Department of Education says the effort looks beyond the schools for ways to boost achievement.
Promise Neighborhoods recognizes the importance of a high-quality school at the center, but allows the community-based organizations to actually drive the sets of relationships first that actually can pull it all together.
At this moment, community organizers across the country are sweating over their computer terminals, struggling to fill out a complicated grant application that runs 64 pages long. Though the administration only plans to fund 20 promised neighborhoods, 943 organizations have said they want to apply, from the Cherokee Nation to Catholic Charities of Middlesex County, New Jersey. Before they hit the send button, here's a word of caution.
This is very, very difficult work.
Children's Zone CEO and founder Jeffrey Canada has become a media darling with books and documentaries extolling his charismatic leadership and his prodigious fundraising abilities. For those jumping into this game for the first time, Canada says it's harder than it looks.
We need the first group of these to be successful. We don't think this is really a place for folk who are just really trying to understand or beginning this approach. We think this is an opportunity for really seasoned professionals.
The question now is whether Jeffrey Canada's recipe will work in other parts of the country or whether the attempt to duplicate the zone might be too much of a stretch for some groups. In the past, organizations have started promising programs only to find they fell apart when they expanded too fast. A look at one of the applicants for the Promised Neighborhoods grants in tomorrow's story. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
I'm Steve Inskeep. In the World Cup, the United States beat Algeria yesterday in the final game of group play, putting the USA through to the second round. A dramatic goal at the end was the game's only score. From South Africa, NPR's Mike Pesca reports.
They sang the anthem, they sang When the Yanks Go Marching In, they sang Olé, 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 they pogoed and partied in Pretoria, 500 fans remaining almost an hour after Landon Donovan had put their team into the knockout round. Bridget Gonzalez of Los Angeles was kind of excited.
Finally, in the last minutes of the game, we get to the goal, and never give up hope. If you're an American, you never give up hope.
But during the game, as the clock ticked towards the 90th minute, there were looks of consternation under the red, white, and blue face paint. It's a weird thing to see someone in a stovepipe hat and an Uncle Sam beard tensely squeeze his fists, as if the more he tightened, the more he could wrench that one bit of goal-scoring magic that eluded the Americans all game. The team had plenty of chances, but the ball would be struck right at the Algerian keeper, or pretty crosses would skitter away inches from a forward's foot. Actually, the U.S. did score in the first half, as ESPN described it.
It's in! Clint Dempsey, but it's going to be disallowed for offside. And the cheers are stilled in the throats of the massive American support here.
Fans at the game suspected they were wrong, but were not provided with a replay. Instead, the in-stadium screens cut to a shot of Bill Clinton looking a bit pained, maybe wondering what the definition of offsides is. This was all too much. After the injustice of a disallowed goal against Slovenia, would the Americans be cursing and rueing instead of eyeing and ooing? The Algerians had to win too, yet they seemed content just to frustrate the U.S., never opening themselves up. Time ticked on, and half a country away, the English established a lead in their game and held on. By the time that game was over, the announcers on the South African Broadcasting Company assumed England had finished first in the group.
England have answered their critics. It wasn't a particularly outstanding performance, but England have got out their group, and it looks like they could well have won the group as well.
But during injury time, the period when the referee can concede a few more minutes of hope, the USA's best player, Landon Donovan, came through. Josie Altidore on the left side sent a fine cross toward the goal. The Algerian keeper played it, but was met by one of his backs and Clint Dempsey. In basketball, this would be called crashing the boards, and Dempsey's efforts seemed to keep the ball alive. ESPN had the call.
Crossed, and Dempsey is denied again, but Donovan has scored! Oh, can you believe this? Go, go, USA!
Afterwards, Donovan told ESPN's Jeremy Schapp that his teammates had brushed off lousy refereeing and were unfazed by adversity.
We embody what Americans are about. We can moan about it, or we can get on with it, and we kept going. And we believe, man.
You're alive.
We're alive, baby.
And there was Coach Bob Bradley, a man for whom the word understated is an understatement, positively emoting.
A lot of emotion, man. These guys put a lot into it. They never quit. You know, we were pushing hard for a goal. It made for a wide open game, but, you know, we knew we needed to win.
And because they did, the USA next faces Ghana, likely to be the only African team still playing in this African World Cup. And U.S. fans just might keep singing till Saturday. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Johannesburg, South Africa.